Hey, this is WTOP's Jason Fraley, and we are being joined by, just say your name and your title.
My name is Tom Little, and I am the creator of the workshop of the Haunted Boy Project,
which is presented by Joe's Movement Emporium, which is located at 3309 Bunker Hill Road, Mount Rainier, Maryland. And it's going to be now through Sunday. So, hey, thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, thanks so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
Our WTOP listeners just voted The Exorcist as the scariest movie of all time. We did like a Halloween bracket. So this is perfect.
Absolutely.
Before we get into, you know, the actual theatrical show, you know, let's start with sort of the backstory of the actual real life story. You know what I mean? So basically, The Exorcist was sort of inspired by this, and William Peter Blatty was read about this. And there's an article in the Post, and it was a real thing. So tell me about sort of the real story.
Yeah, it was actually based on a real family in Cottage City, Maryland, which is a DC suburb right next to Mount Rainier, where I live. And this family, it was actually a boy and not a girl. It was in the 1940s, mid-1940s. And this young man who was about to turn 14 really started having this breakdown and really displaying some behaviors that were really scary to the family. So the family over time decided to put him through the Catholic rite of exorcism, and as well as taking him to see psychologists, which were very different back then than they are today. And the science of psychology was different. And so this family, our story that we're telling is more of a story of the family rather than what William Peter Blatty, who wrote the Exorcist franchise based, decided to do with the story. He read these articles coming out in the Washington Post and other papers about this family because it kind of blew up. And he was at Georgetown University at the time, and that's when he got the idea started working on The Exorcist, the book, and eventually the screenplay.
Absolutely. And thanks for giving the backstory. Yeah, I have mm-hmm. I have the Washington Post article up right now. The article it says priest frees Mount Rainier boy reportedly held in devil's grip. It's by Bill Brinkley, Washington Post, Friday, August 20th, 1949. Wow. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's that blew my mind. Yeah, and we interviewed William Friedkin, the director of The Exorcist, a couple years ago, back when they dedicated the steps in Georgetown. They like made it like a city landmark or something, the famous steps.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
he was him and Blatty were there. I know Blatty's passed now, but they both showed up and were talking all about this case. It was 1949, and Blatty was like, I guess he went to like a Jesuit school in Brooklyn before he came down here. But yeah, I think he went to Georgetown and maybe GW and came across this, and horror history was made. It's a pretty cool backstory, man.
It's really amazing, and it's cool for us over on this side of the city. There's all these local legends around what actually happened here, even down to disputes about where it happened. Some people in Mount Rainier think it happened in Mount Rainier, and that the house burnt down, and that there was they built a gazebo on top of it. So there's a park that people go and mess around in. And then other people in Colmar Manor thought it was there in Cottage City. So there's all this local lore around it, both in our little towns over here on the edge of DC, as well as all the way throughout DC.
So you're saying it wasn't Mount Rainier. You're saying it was slightly in Cottage City is what it's because
it was in Cottage City, Maryland. That's what the the sources that we looked at and what we thought were as close to fact as you can get. I mean, there's a lot of rumors out there. There's a lot of stories out there, but the ones we found, we really looked at a book by a guy named Mark Obsasnik, who wrote a book called The True Story of the Exorcist. He looked at all the documents that were out there and found that nobody had really actually talked to many of the people in Mount Rainier or in this area and the neighbors. And so he came and just tromped around Mount Rainier a number of years back and he found the home, and he found the friends, and he found many people to interview, and came up with his own assertions about what went on. But we use that as a really strong source material for what we wrote. Awesome. Though I will say this, we are decidedly not writing a biography of this family. We use the family and a lot of the events around the family as kind of signposts in our story. But we really wanted to kind of craft a new narrative around what would happen. You know, what writing songs is, you know, a very human enterprise. And so we were really interested in finding the human stories behind, you know, the decisions that, what was going on with the boy? What was that, that made him like, what did it look like? What did it sound like at school? What did it look like for his friends and his neighbors? What would the mother feel like when she's taking him to the psychologist? What would the psychologist say? What would the priest, the first priest in the local priest from St. James, what would they say about this case as it was happening and unfolding? And so that's really where we camped our story. So people, you brought up The Exorcist as the scariest movie. You know, a lot of people are asking, you know, is this a scary show? And I mean, I think that there's scary elements of, you know, we're dealing with a case of mental illness, a psychological breakdown, the questionable decisions that maybe a family would make around a son, but also the scary decisions that parents would have to make for their son. There's an element of scariness to that, but ours is much more human than a fantastically scary or horrific story.
Gotcha. And with music. I want to get to the rock opera, the music in one second. But first, real quick, we'll talk about sort of the narrative you crafted around this. Like you're saying, it's not a direct, you know, you're in a biography. You have to have a little creative license because you got to be able to make a damn, you know, stage play out of it, musical. What's the name of the family and who's the main character in your version? You know, do you give the family a name?
Yes, we did. We named our the boy Roland. We gave them the last name Knocknable.
How do you spell that?
So Roland is Roland. And the last name is Knechtenebel.
And Roland, does that stand for something? Is there a reason?
Yeah, well, so they were German Lutherans. And so I was looking for a name because we really didn't want to actually use the real names of the family. Sure. Because we're not telling their story as a biography.
I never found actually, the real names, by the way. I don't think the Post put the real names in, did they?
They did not. If you go to the Obsasnik book, they do. They name the family and they give the address of the house. And, you know, I've been to the house or been by the house. I've met the owners.
So tell me about Roland.
So Roland Knocknable, and there was a meaning behind it. It was a little bit of a, we put a few Easter eggs throughout. And I was looking for a German last name and I found Knocknable, which means night fog, which kind of played into what I was going for nice. What we were going for with Roland. So our character is Roland Knocknable and he's joined in our telling of the story by his mother, Emmeline Knocknable. And then a cast of characters, including his aunt, a psychologist, a priest, a Jesuit, another Jesuit priest who comes on later for the final exorcism scene. The demon, of course, and we play with questions of, is the demon really there or a figment of his imagination or a product of mental illness? There's also a reporter. We really wanted to have the ability to get the story out to the public, just like William Peter Blatty would have read and much of Washington, D.C. would have read at that time, and to create the ability for explaining how this became the legacy that it's become. You know, it happened because people talked about it. And so we also wanted to have neighbors and friends to be able to kind of gossip about it and then give stories to the reporter who then takes it out into the world. So we kind of created all these archetypal characters first, and then we started naming them and making them talk to each other through song.
Do you, by the end of the show, you know, no spoilers, you know, but do you come to a conclusion of whether you think it was something that the priest could handle or that it was a psychological, or do you kind of try to walk that line and through the reporter and everything, you try to like leave it open to our interpretation?
We leave that question to the audience. And I think we did a pretty good job of writing it in a way that we're not forcing a conclusion down people's throats. We're really leaving it open to you and your own belief structure as you watch this. But we are also really addressing this from a standpoint that, you know, it, where we are presenting kind of what the boy is going through, and you know, the actual boy, from the interviews with his friends and people around him, he was going through a really tough time at school. He was really struggling. He was kind of a loner, very, very smart and intelligent young man, who was also loved to be involved with mischief and playing tricks and practical jokes on people. The rumor had it that he was actually actively trying to get himself kicked out of school. So he was acting out in all these really strange ways. And then also right at that time, which is considered a triggering point, is he lost one of his family members, his aunt, who was very, very close with him, and who he identified with very much. And so we really took that as a trigger point for our for the jumping off point for our rock opera, with the death of a loved one, that when he's kind of down on his luck and really struggling, that it kind of pushes him even farther. By the end of the show, we're definitely not telling you what to believe. And we don't really ever come to a conclusion of that, but we do come to a conclusion of that he gets himself out of the whatever possession he's in, without necessarily telling you what's next either.
Gotcha. Cool. Well, I think we've thoroughly covered the backstory and then also your story, you know, your narrative here with Roland. So the other, you know, final piece is the actual music, because this is a rock opera. You know, when you say rock opera, I don't know, people think like Jesus Christ Superstar, I don't even know, mm-hmm. Rent or something. I'm trying to think of the genre, or Hedwig, something like that maybe. But like, what talk about sort of the music. How would you classify it? You know, like, what kind of instruments, or, you know what I mean? Go into music.
So the whole thing started last year. I was offered to be the artist in residence at the Brentwood Arts Exchange, which is a local art and music venue here in Mount Rainier. Actually, it's in Brentwood, which is right next door. The end result of that was that they wanted me to do new work. And I love to collaborate with other musicians and artists. And so I asked for some more money and asked them if they would allow me to start a songwriting workshop. And so what I did is I asked a number of artists that I know personally from just the music scene of DC, and then other people that I really was a fan of their music. And we eventually found, we're at 10 people to work on this songwriting workshop. And I put out songwriting prompts to them and ideas. And last year what we presented was we basically wrote the characters into song. So it wasn't a full narrative. So we performed last November the kind of character songs, 10 brand new songs that we wrote in about 3 months. And from there, it was a great success. We really loved it. Everybody in the project was really excited. And from there, we then moved into phase two, which was now making all these characters talk to each other. And so I got a number of those artists to sit down and kind of start a steering committee with me to kind of be able to create a narrative. And then phase two is send out more prompts and to fit that narrative, we all wrote the music together. And we all come at this from lots of different standpoints. You know, some of the folks in our project are folk musicians. Some of them are punk rock musicians. Some of them are more bluesy or jazzy or country. And what has been really amazing about it is that because all of the artists who are playing characters are also a part of the band, and even though we have these disparate styles that come together, the band fills it out in a way that has this really clear what's the word I'm looking for? There's a cohesion to it because everybody is both writing for it in their own style, but also playing in the band together and lending their ear in different ways. Because it's a story about The Exorcist, and because it's a story about, not The Exorcist, but a story about this family who inspired The Exorcist, you know, we use the music to really tell a lot of the stories. So, you know, the character of Roland needs to have to get loud. And so we really use kind of rock and roll and loud guitars to do that. But the character of the mother, who might be, you know, in a reverie of prayer about her son, like that's going to be a little quieter. We ended up calling it a rock opera because it is also not a piece of music theater where there's no acting in between songs. So often the difference between music theater and opera is an opera is sung all the way through with very few breaks in music, whereas music theater, you have acting and that then breaks into song. So that's why we kind of landed on the opera part. And then, you know, because we kind of get loud and kind of move through, it's not rock and roll the whole time, but we get there quite a bit, because of the subject matter. So that's how we landed on the idea of calling it a rock opera, kind of fit well.
What are some of the numbers? Could you go into some of them? Like, just give me an anecdote or two, like a song title.
Yeah. So for, you know, one of the part of the songwriting workshop was I would give a prompt and then sometimes a keyword. For the first round, I gave everybody a different prompt, but I gave everybody the same keyword, which was kind of a play on words of the Exorcist franchise, which was head spinning. You know, there's all these, you know, in the original, you've got the actual actress, the little girl with her head like spinning around. And I was like, well, that sound like if we did that in song and weren't actually doing that thing, you know, it's a great way of talking about, you know, the way that people felt around this case. And so one of the songs is called Head Spinning. It's a big rocker. It's the first kind of entry of the boy's thoughts and how he's feeling and kind of all this. And so it's kind of an angsty rock and roll song. We have one that I love, which is called The Devil Ain't the Half of It. And that is our psychologist right after he meets Roland and they have their first interaction. And then he then eventually goes to the house and kind of witnesses the priest try to give the first kind of exorcism or pray over the boy, and it kind of fails miserably. He gives his assessment of it, and the song is called The Devil Ain't the Half of It. It's a great song by a guy named Steve Kolowich, who's on our cast, who wrote that. It's a really awesome kind of rock and roll piece. There's a lot of ones that I wrote, you know, I'm the demon in this musical, or I'm sorry, I'm the demon in this rock opera. And so the term fire had to come up a lot. It's such a descriptive word and it was such a visual word. And so there's one called Firepower, which is the demon trying to kind of possess the boy and get into his head. And then later on, we come back with the one called The Fire of Love, which is kind of a piece at the end with between where the boy has to make a decision about which direction he goes to kind of get himself out of this. There's so many. It is 21 songs long. And it's two acts with an intermission. Again, it's not acted throughout, but the way we've staged it is that the characters who are singing the lead when they're not part of the band, when they're singing lead, they are singing in character and the mics are set and we're interacting with each other quite a bit. And we've had really great reviews so far. People are really blown away with not only the music, but also just the way we've presented it, and the staging and Joe's Movement Emporium has done a fantastic job of hosting us, and their crew there has just been amazing.
Yeah. Tell me sort of about, you know, the actual outfit that's putting this thing on, you know, Joe's Movement Emporium. If some of our listeners maybe they've never actually been there or aren't familiar with it.
So Joe's Movement Emporium is a art space here in Mount Rainier, Maryland. It's been here for a long time, and they do all sorts of things. They have art studios, they have kids camps, they have adult workshops, they have writing workshops, they have yoga studios and dance workshops and dance studios. And then they have this black box theater, which seats about 130 people. And they do all sorts of performances there, from music to dance to art to you name it. They are an arts organization that has just been a kind of an anchor point for the Gateway District over here between Mount Rainier and Hyattsville in the Route 1 corridor. I've been going to Joe's for quite some time. It's in my neighborhood. I love the space. And so when we were thinking about putting this on, we really wanted it to be So it is a local story because it's, you know, the house where I'm sitting right now, the house where the boy was, where the family was, that this bit is based on, is 8 blocks away. And
that's creepy.
Joe's Movement Emporium is 8 blocks away from me in the other direction. And
you're right in the middle.
Yeah. And many of the artists who are, so there's 10 artists and I think 6 of them live in this neighborhood as well. And so we really wanted to start, you know, and we don't know where this is going to go. We think it might have some legs to maybe present it in some other towns or cities, or maybe, you know, kind of reimagine it in a more staged version. We're really focusing on what we're doing right now, but we think it might have some legs to go somewhere. When we were thinking about doing it for the first time, we really wanted, because it's many local musicians and a local story, we wanted to do it in a local venue, and Joe's Movement Emporium really stepped it up. But it's also, this is not just Joe's Movement, they are helping to put it on, but we're being sponsored by MNC PPC, which is Maryland Parks and Planning. They've been really helping out. And also Brentwood Arts Exchange, which was where the first show happened of the character stories, kind of what we called Chapter One last year. And so they've been helping us out as well. And then also DC Brow over here on the side of the city. They've been a sponsor of ours. And actually this upcoming Friday, we're doing an event where if you there are beer sponsors throughout, so you can get a beer when you come to the show. But after the show on Friday, there's going to actually be an after party, which is at DC Brow, which is 8 blocks the other direction from where I'm sitting. And they're going to stay open until midnight doing half price pours for anybody who had have a ticket. So it's a great time to meet some of the cast afterwards and have a great beverage and support one of our sponsors.
Yeah. Just don't drink too much or your head will be spinning.
That's right.
Or the room will be, one or the other.
Yeah, who knows?
Your head will be shaking. Well, very cool. That's cool. You're doing a party. And that's really cool that it's all like all local, you know, musicians and actors. And that's like cool. It's cool that you're starting where this whole story began. It's really cool. All right. So it sounds like there's 3 more shows by the time this runs. So we're going to have Friday at 7, Saturday at 7, and Sunday at 5. We'll close it out. So
that is correct. Yeah. We sold out the last weekend, both Friday and Saturday, and almost sold out on Sunday. Tickets are going really fast, actually. I just got word that we've sold 100 tickets for each of those evenings coming up, and there's only about 30 tickets left. So get them while you can. We've been really having a successful run so far, and people are really, really ecstatic about what they're seeing. We're getting great feedback. Also Saturday night, I'll put this out there, is also ASL interpreted. So for those who are in the deaf community, if they would like to come out for an American Sign Language interpreted show, we'll be doing that. And there'll also be headphones available for those who are hard of hearing on Saturday. Friday night is a big after party at DC Brow. And Sunday night, we're going to be closing it out in style with our matinee at 5 p.m.
Awesome. So head to joesmovement.org to figure out everything about the tickets. And cool. I guess before we run, pretend like I'm not even here. Like you're talking directly to the listeners. Like, hey, everyone, come on out to the Haunted Boy. You're going to have a good time.
Sure. Hey, everybody. This is Tom Little from the Haunted Boy Project. I'd love to see your shining faces this weekend at our final run of this show on Friday, Saturday, Sunday. And get your tickets at joesmovementemporium.org or at thehauntedboyproject.com.
All right. Thanks for doing this. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for reaching out.